Now it's time, this is the point to introduce the two panelists to you from the panel here. The gentleman next to Jerry is Richard Warren Jr. He is curator of the historical sound recordings at Yale University Library. And next to him is Claudia Depkin. She is the archivist of BMG Archive in New York. And interesting, as now we have here an archive which is not part of the YASA or ASK structure. I have a couple of points on which I would like to focus our discussion, and once again I would like to have your participation as well. The first point is the point of centralization. We've heard from Jerry's report that he has used many small archives as well as the big ones. And all this involves traveling. If we had one huge archive at one place where all records are kept in ideal conditions, where they can be heard under ideal conditions, and where everything is perfect. Let's imagine this state. Of course, we would never have that, but if we had it, would this be a good idea, or would this be a bad idea? Would it be the beginning of discography and of discology, the real beginning, or would it be the end of it? Who would like to answer my question? Well, if you, yes, or yeah, Dr. Lotz, yeah.
I wouldn't like, or I couldn't answer that question, but a short remark. Chris has introduced the rhetoric question about the objective indicators for the cultural significance of sound recordings. And I think it would be more appropriate to talk about the public awareness of the significance of historic sound recordings. And the very sad answer to that is it is almost nil. And that, of course, reflects the fact that funding for sound archives is almost nil. And I give you two examples to make that point. I'm presently engaged in documenting the German national discography. In doing so, I have estimated that there are about 1 million sound recordings made in Germany over the past 80 years during the Schellack era. Now, the majority of those recordings have a very low market value of a few Deutschmarks only. Now, just imagine for a second what is being paid by art galleries for an average Picasso. For one average Picasso, you could, in theory at least, buy any sound recording ever made in Germany. Secondly, compare the accessibility, the availability, the user-friendliness of sound archives with the average library. Jerome has explained that serious researchers are always welcome. All the archives are available for serious researchers. Just imagine for 1 second that all the public libraries would close down and only be open to serious researchers. This is a discrepancy which is reflecting our attitude towards our cultural heritage. Thank you.
Thank you. Perhaps may we, if there's an answer to my question, or if somebody feels there's an answer, Vincent, would you? You're looking so as if you would like to try to answer it.
By the way, I'm Vincent Pallote. I'm representing, I guess, on this panel, the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University in Newark. As far as I know, it's the only jazz archive in the world devoted to the entire spectrum of jazz, not just a section like the New Orleans music of the Tulane University Hogan Archive. In answer to your question, one thing I wouldn't like about your dream archive is that if there was an earthquake or something, all that stuff would be gone in one fell swoop. also, I just don't think it's a good idea to have all this stuff in one place, because that means all hiring staff. Logistically, it's just a bad idea. But that's about the only answer I really have to that. I guess it would solve a lot of traveling if you're running around looking for specific things, and instead of going to all these different archives, you can just go to one and get everything you need. But that's about my only attempt at answering that.
So perhaps then, I guess we all agree to that. One other point is, I mean, if one makes a mistake at that archive, just one tiny mistake in terms of acquisition, than cultural heritage, just a tiny fraction, but perhaps a fraction important for one researcher, will be totally lost. But then we should think that because it's a bad idea to centralize sound archives or to centralize the sources, we should more focus on how we can put a network over the various archives. And I guess this is something which YASA should a little bit more look into in respect to its activities, because there are many archives, many sound archives, which are not sound archives as such, but which have just departments of sound archives, and which are parts of larger libraries or larger archives, and they are basically only known by people if they happen to know of them, like your small archive just a few blocks from your flat. And I think this is very important for the researcher, that there's sort of not just union catalog, but it's a network system among these archives. And very important also, I think, is the additional material, additional to sound recordings. We've heard from the lecture of Mike Gray that virtually a research project like that, which is very interesting and important, can only be done if some written material is kept somewhere. I mean, you didn't make up these drafts, these diagrams of the recording session settings, just from listening to the records, because but you looked them up, of course, or you interviewed people, so you did either oral history, or you just looked into papers which are kept somewhere in archives. And here's the point of the sound recording of the company recording archives. BMG is one of the major recording companies worldwide, and it has a very long history, not under the name of BMG, but under the name of RCA or Victor. And I wonder how, in such an archive, the material is collected, and if there have been reflections on the need of keeping also not just the recording ledgers, but for instance the scores, the annotated scores used by the recording director for marking tape slices, for instance. Particularly now in the age of digitalization, we have no material, nothing we can grab with our hands and look and count. Oh, there's a tape splice, and there's another one, just two inches length. Everything is lost because we just have digits. So Claudia, may I ask you to tell us a little bit about the work of your archive and how you could, if you as an archivist have the possibility to tell your colleagues that they should keep the material and not just keep it in their drawers, but hand it over to the main archive.
Well, there are certain parts of that I can address easier than others. Unfortunately, I'm not really familiar with the tape side of things, but I can say for certain that in terms of Chris's hierarchy, we deal mostly with the second aspect, with performers. We know the who, the what, the when, and the where, and the matrix numbers that go along with it, and the recordings that were then sent out for commercial release and that sort of thing. Excuse me, I'm a little nervous. but certainly, I think if we could get all the information that people have, for instance, people don't necessarily give to us scores. We just keep the paperwork that we've created, essentially. I mean, we're corporate archives, and so our records are maintained just through daily routines. And in fact, we've dropped off at certain time periods, we've got some gaps, but I'd say fairly accurately we can maintain, or we can recall what we've got from 1902-ish, probably. I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I don't know if anyone has any questions in particular for me from this angle.
Claudia,
yes.
Have you received requests from researchers for information?
Regularly, yes. Certainly. We receive a lot of calls for appointments. People do come in, researchers. In fact, we've just been dealing with Barry Crawford and the Leonard Warren Foundation. They're putting out they're doing reissues of Leonard Warren's recordings, as well as a discography that's coming out in 1997. So we do have people, we are open to the public, again, for serious researchers. also journalists who come in occasionally, and we get a lot of requests from magazines for photographs and that for artwork. We do have about 125 linear feet of artwork, which we are happy to give to people, and publicity information and things like that about our artists. And we're always we're always willing to help, obviously, if someone's got some questions that they need. We get a lot of requests, in fact, just for people looking for out-of-print recordings. And we're always willing to direct people to where they can find things. There's a question, yes. By a wide range, what do you...
All the details that Martin was alluding to, scores match recording details, mic placements, all of that sort of data, which we're beginning to understand, have done for some time, is actually very important in the understanding of the history of recording, which perhaps in the past record companies have not necessarily picked. Is this now part of your job, or is it something that is still not terribly...
It will be part of my job, as perhaps from this point on. I'd say we're still we're still dealing with this. We're coming into this from a different angle than I think most of the people in this room are. Our main interest is making records. and with the bottom line in mind, obviously. And that type of information, which is important to engineers as well as important to collectors who, you know, for discographical, like, you know, just for interest, for liner notes and that kind of thing, from henceforth we are becoming more involved in that aspect of things. But to this point, I'd say not yet. Yes.
Yes.
Why don't you come here? Thank you.
Let me talk. The question came up, and I'm not going to talk about the library archives. I'm going to talk about record company archives because I've spent a considerable number of days and weeks in such places. And let me just talk for a minute about the talk that I gave this morning. Deutsche Grammophon did not keep setup sheets until 1971 when they started to do multitrack. Whatever I found here was from the memories of the engineers who were kind enough to talk to me and send me what they'd done. At Capitol Records, the studio manager in 1982 decided that all the setup sheets for the Capitol catalog were just useless, taking up space in a room, and one day he decided he was going to do something about that. The next day, Simon Cannell said, "Where are all our setup sheets?" "Well, I thought they were junk. I threw them away." When BMG moved, RCA moved from its old studio offices uptown in the late 60s, all the paperwork was thrown away for the engineering side. The same thing applied to a certain extent to Columbia when they closed down their studios. You see what I'm getting at here? The sense that the engineering material, at least, was historically important was not considered to be significant. It's only because Kenneth Wilkinson at Decca kept what are called electrical records of session, which I have all the copies that are extant of myself, thanks to David Frost, that such documents exist. There are no RCA setup sheets as such. There are a few that were kept by an engineer named Tony Salvatore. There are a few in boxes. As Claudia says, and I'm one of the people who bugs Claudia from time to time, she's such a sweet person to put up with me. Record companies are in the business of making records. They're not in the business of keeping records as far as paper is concerned. We should be thankful that BMG, through Bernadette and Claudia and the EMI archives and Ruth Edge, have a sense of historical responsibility and maintain this material as long as they have, in spite of the pressures to do otherwise, the pressures that I've already mentioned, the trash can.
And to expand what Michael said, of course, he's talking primarily about classical music. As you probably all know, jazz sure as hell didn't have any such things as setup sheets or scores. And because it wasn't considered as highly as it is now, even being considered that highly now, a lot of the metal parts and things were tossed out or melted down during the war effort, and so a lot of music's been lost that way. What I'd like to ask Claudia is, putting you on the spot again, the idea of record companies being in the business of making money, which is, you know, a nice thing to do. Unfortunately, it's also given the companies a bad knock for people like us who want to preserve everything, anything, and everything. Is that now becoming important to record companies like BMG to preserve what metal parts you do have or other recordings that you do have to make sure that they'll be there for future generations? And it also means, I certainly hope you're not just putting it all on that tapes and hoping that that's going to last forever. Could you answer that?
We are, in fact, in the process of trying to save all the information that we have, all the recordings that we have. We've just moved our vault, happily, to a new location that's climate controlled. We're doing, Glenn Corman, who's a manager of preservation, is working with a group of people creating analog and digital safeties of recordings, of our glass parts, our metal parts, our tapes. We are we do realize what we have. It's perhaps not as early as it could have been, maybe. It's hard to say. We've got a very expanding, ambitious department right now. And we're interested in preserving both the paper that we have that Bernadette and I deal with, Bernadette Moore, and I deal with, which is sort of what leads you to these recordings. And we know what we've got. there's several reissue labels going right now. Bluebird has been rejuvenated, the Bluebird label. There's a Heritage and Blues series that's coming out. We've got an Essential series from Nashville, a 24-karat gold collector series, which is pop music. I mean, things, we're realizing, wow, we've got a lot of stuff. The RCA's strength is in its back catalog at this point, and so all that's being remastered. And so, yes. We're working with other companies right now to actually create a database. Again, we're back to networking, but part of one of the large expenses, I'd say, of these different labels that come to us, labels meaning RCA or Nashville or BMG Classics, there's a lot of time and expense and effort at this point involved in doing research, so you can even just pull these parts from the vaults. And so our database will obviously simplify that system with the systemization of numbers and artists and composers and publishers and all that information. It will make everyone's job much simpler, in which case it will be much more cost efficient once, the initial expenses are absorbed. Yes.
Yes.
Sorry. Thank you. From my company, I say thank you. yes.
I suppose a bit of the answer to that is to look at the ARSC and the AAA, which did manage to find support many years ago. I can't even remember what year we began to do the project that came out as the Rigler Deutsch Index, and that was possible because we were able to obtain funding. To me, just speaking personally, recently the AAA seems to be on very difficult times, and to speak for my institution, you are looking at the entire staff of the Historical Sound Recordings Collection, reference, engineering, help with reissues, however you want to look at it. It's been that way now for, this is the third or fourth year. So there's rather little that I can do for anyone. Especially if they're outside the coursework of Yale University, which pays the rent and has to come first. We've talked, we've had wonderful friendships in the archives group, and also talking to people in archives which aren't in that particular group, and with collectors and researchers like Jerry Weber and many others. And it's fascinating, and I would love to do more, but I just don't quite see how. There's a cylinder project that Bill Klinger has been working on, which we're trying to figure out how to help. People are constantly doing various bits of company or national discography, as you have heard here many times. And so to me, the quick off the top of the head answer to the problem is, yes, let's go on and let's do more of this, but we need support from somewhere to do that. If somebody from, if BMG came to Yale and said, help us with our archives, there wouldn't be much that I could say or do, except for bits of brief advice. And I hear from my colleagues, whom I don't see as much anymore because of not having the time or the resources to get places, that this kind of staffing problem and funding or resource problem seems to be all over the place. I have felt, in spite of being the only staff member, that I'm still fairly well off compared to some others. So I think we have a big problem, which another person mentioned, of the public recognition and possible support that may come from that.
Linked one with another. How many people here have looked at the various music indexes on the internet? A few. Well, what's called a hyperlink is a method that once you find one particular site, say that someone at the University of Missouri has something, they'll refer you to other sites. And I've poked around in a little. There are some sites of, let's say, Bach. Somebody has typed up the Bach Werke for Schachner. Somebody typed up the Kircher catalog. Somebody typed up Beethoven. It was very incomplete. These are just the beginning of these things. As far as discographies go, now, just classical music is all I have looked at, is just a list of recommended recordings. Now, I posted a couple of things myself on some of the discussion groups. There's one discussion group called Recreation Classical Music, and one Rec Classical Music Recordings. There's another one coming up for opera, and there are hundreds of stuff for non-classical music. I posted one that I've done on acoustic chamber music. There's also a group that's devoted to 78 records that occurs by email. It's run by Cornell University. And that's mostly popular. But there's some people there that have some rather detailed knowledge about the process of making recordings. But more and more, this sort of thing is going to grow. And it's going to be funded by not anybody full time, but just some amateurs that probably work in colleges that just have some spare time on their hands and start putting some of these things together. But there's a method of linking, of jumping from point to point to point. And you eventually find out, you get somebody put together all these Bach, list of all the Bach resources. And you go to them, and then these resources refer you back to the other. So there's just there's a close circle of these things. But this is how it's going to grow. Now, my advice for your discographers, sir, that anyone's put together a discography has found out that all discographies have mistakes in them, including the ones you put together yourself. I was updating a discography I published in the Ars Journal of Evgeny Mravinsky, and I noticed a couple of terrible howlers in it. But nobody else caught them. And also, all discographies, if you ever put one together, not only have mistakes, but they're filled with conjectures. And this is just an art. Now, I was getting started on this. I was corresponding with Jerry Weber, and he pointed this out, that you just become more knowledgeable and you just have to make these judgments. And if you have any two discographers, they're going to disagree with each other on some fairly minor thing, but to them are very major. What I suggest when you make up your discographies is just, if you do make a judgment, try to document the judgment. Now, some discographies have actually referred back to other discographies and pointed out the mistakes in them. And sometimes they've been mistakes, too. One I can think of is Terry Noah Towle put together a discography of Casals for a biography of a fellow by the name of Kirk, I believe. And he pointed out some errors in some other discographies. Well, it turned out that Towle himself is wrong. The first guy had it right. So you have this all over the place, but if you can try to document your know-how, sometimes you just make these judgments, you just kind of know something, you just get more and more experience. If you can try to document your judgments, others, when they refer back to that, can sort of know the basis on which you did it. But anyhow, I see there's just going to be this growing web of these things, and someone's going to have to take a scanner or just start reading these things into different sites on the internet. And I think that's going to be the whole future of discography. It's going to be worked by amateurs. It's not going to be centrally planned. It's going to grow up spontaneously. There's going to be lots of mistakes. It's essentially a very elaborate continuation of what we have already.
It's a very good point. And we're sort of seriously infringing on the lunch period at this point. I think we should entertain maybe one more question before we wrap it up. Is that okay with you, Martin, or do you have another?
Remark.
Okay.
I wanted to come back to the point Rainer raised with the Picasso and the millions of records one can buy for that. Of course, records are not yet good for speculation purposes. I mean, the price of a Picasso paid by the Deutsche Bank is primarily a different kind of investment. And it's better to have it something which is worth 2 million in that size instead of this room here. But this brings us to another point. Perhaps the sound archives or the sound archivism hasn't got that much money yet because the value is not really established of a sound recording. The value behind the mere artifact. And for that, we really need research. We need more research and not just research which deals with the listing of records, but which goes beyond it. So we have to establish, we have to foster discological research. And I think this is a subject which, or this is a matter which ought to be tackled by the sound archives in order that they make themselves more, that they give them more importance to the public and to politicians. And so far I have found a certain disinterest in sound archivism as a source for, or as a stimulant in that respect. There are, of course, there are several exceptions from this rule. For instance, the small sound archive in Switzerland, the Schweizerische Landesphonothek, they have a series of lectures or annual seminars. This perhaps sound archives should be a bit more interested in. Otherwise, they really risk that they collect just for the sake of collecting. and for the sake of establishing themselves in a closed environment. Now it is 1:05, and I guess you all are hungry, and I suggest we close now, unless there is one remark, and a small one, yes. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you to the panel, to the contributors, and thank you for joining this session.